Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of True Story on the Authors on the Air Network. I'm your host, Brian Freeman, and I'm the author of 15 best-selling psychological thrillers. Well, have you missed me? I've been on hiatus for a few weeks as I hit the road to launch my latest novel, Alter Ego, which is available right now from Quercus Hachette. But never fear, I am back, and we have an amazing lineup of nonfiction books for you to discover in the next few months. We've got everything from the lost colony of Roanoke in the 16th century to the Rolling Stones at Altamont in 1969. And it starts right now with my latest guest, Nancy Goldstone, who is author of the new book, Daughters of the Winter Queen. It's the story of Elizabeth Stuart, known as the Winter Queen for her brief stint as the Queen of Bohemia, and her four daughters, five women who were at the center of war, politics, religion, and culture throughout the tumultuous 17th century. Oh, and who, by the way, managed to take over the British monarchy's line of succession that has continued all the way down to Queen Elizabeth and today's royal family. Now, if you are one of those people that think of nonfiction history books as dull and dry, well, I'm here to tell you that some pages of this book read like they're taken from a chapter of Game of Thrones, and others read like a TV season of Dynasty, with scheming, backbiting secret affairs, heaving bosoms, and knockdown drag-out fights. So, welcome to the 17th century, and Nancy, welcome to True Story.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, you know, one of the things that I really appreciated about your book was your sense of humor. I thought you had this great wry way of describing the people events and you know, poking fun at some of the more absurd things that you encounter in the era. I made a note of one of my favorite lines. It was, let's see here. There were, in fact, so many Habsburgs stretched so broadly with so much property to protect that often the only suitable candidate for marriage to a Habsburg was another Habsburg. And while these unions did result in more Habsburgs, sadly, they were not always of the finest quality.
Yes. you introduced the emperor.
you obviously have a lot of fun with your subjects. Can you talk just a little bit about that and kind of, you know, what really, you know, it gives you your passion for these stories?
Well, a lot of the time it's you know, I'm not a person who likes any fiction getting in the way of my history, because the history is stuff that you just couldn't make up. And that's what makes it so fun to do, because if you did some of these things in fiction, people would say, oh, no, that couldn't really happen. In fact, I once gave a talk, and a woman came up to me afterwards, and she said to me, you know, I started your book, but I put it down because I thought, oh, this could never, this is just too outlandish, this, somebody made this up. But now I see that it really happened, so I'm going to go back and read it again. So... Because, well, they did everything that we did, only on a much bigger scale.
introduce us to the original heroine of your book, Elizabeth, the Winter Queen.
Okay, so Elizabeth Stuart is Mary Queen of Scots' granddaughter. That's kind of to give you some context. We all know who Mary Queen of Scots was. She's the queen who Elizabeth I. Cut off her head and for treason. And actually but Mary had a son, and he became king of England in one of those weird ways. And his daughter, he had one daughter, and her name was Elizabeth Stuart. And her father, who was Mary, Queen of Scots' only child, James, had originally been king of Scotland, and she was actually born in Scotland. But when Elizabeth I died, she got to come to England with her father. She was about 6 years old. And she went from being in Scotland, was not a wealthy place, but she came to England. When she got to England, England was wealthy, and suddenly she had this kind of fairy tale princess existence. She went from having like two servants to having 200 servants, kind of thing. So she is a princess of England, and she's going to get married, and she eventually marries a German count who's far below her in rank. But the reason that her father marries her to this guy is because first of all, it's cheaper for the dowry, but also he has the promise of being a king because he's a German count, and he wants to become king of Bohemia, which was because he wanted to be of royal blood, and she wanted him to be a king also. And he does eventually become king of Bohemia, but only for one season, because he's trying to take that Bohemia away from the Habsburgs, and they have an army come to take him out.
So hence the winter king and the winter queen. They were for only one season.
They were only there because they were supposed to be. Her father was supposed to help them. England was supposed to help them, but he decided not. He didn't want to commit. He was the original bad dad, I guess. You know, he didn't. he didn't pay his money. He wouldn't give them any money. He wouldn't give them any soldiers. And so they were kind of left out there in the cold, and they had to flee. She actually was pregnant in Prague. There was a battle right outside of Prague. It's a very famous battle called the Battle of White Mountain. And her husband wasn't even at the battle because he was with her at the time having lunch and trying to get money from English ambassadors. And he didn't find out he lost the battle until right after lunch. He went out to see how his army was doing, and he met his own soldiers coming back at him, fleeing the enemy. And they had to basically leave everything just the way it was in the house. They left the used lunch dishes on the table. She's 7 months pregnant. She has to jump on the back of a horse and flee the soldiers. They went so fast they almost left. They had another child with them. They almost left the baby behind. So they... I mean, can you imagine? For me, that was one of the most terrifying moments in the book. Is when I think about somebody who's 7 months pregnant and it's the middle of winter, and they're being chased by the soldiers, and she has to find a place to have the baby. It's very exciting.
And this is the 1600s. I mean, that it's just extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, before I read your book, I had heard kind of little bits and pieces about different historical events in Europe during the 17th century, but I really didn't have a sense of the extraordinary, you know, upheaval in Europe throughout the century. The religious conflict, war, borders changing and rearranging, as so many sort of larger than life historical figures striding across the page. It was an amazing time in the world.
Yes, it was, and it was one of the great things about writing this book was because this is the time of the 30 Years' War, which nobody really knows anything about, and most people don't know who were in it, let alone who won or anything like that. And so when I was writing it, I was able to write it in real time with a lot of suspense, because imagine if you were reading a book about World War II and you didn't know if Hitler won or lost.
Right.
So you're right in the middle of it, and you can feel all the tension of going back and forth, who's going to win and who's not going to win, and who's going to lose. And there was a lot of religious strife, but it was also a lot about power, and who was going to keep the power.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, during the course of her life, Elizabeth had 12 children, including four
13,
daughters.
13, actually.
Was it 13? Okay.
Some of them died.
I enjoyed the way that you, throughout the book, you weave the lives of Elizabeth and her daughters with the big picture of the politics and war playing out around them. So in a chapter, you might have sort of a more intimate focus on what's going on in the lives and household of Elizabeth and the daughters. And then you sort of switch to what the big picture is of sort of what the geopolitical forces are that are going on around them. Why did you choose that structure for how to tell the story?
Well, I wanted to show the sweep of history. You can't really understand. These women are this family is right in the middle of everything that's happening in the 17th century. After Elizabeth Stuart is forced to flee Bohemia with her husband, they end up in Holland and in at The Hague, and it's just the time of the golden age of the Dutch, which is this flowering of art and scholarship and math and all the knowledge is just coming to this made is coming to fruition there, because Holland is kind of tolerant, and so scholars and artists and everyone all come from all over Europe, because there's all this war going on everywhere else. They come to The Hague, and so you're getting all these different trends with her family. One daughter is the eldest daughter is a mathematician and a philosopher and knows Descartes, and the second daughter is an artist and has as her master one of the great artists of the time, Gerrit van Honthorst, and even the youngest daughter is just the education that all these kids got gives them such a heads up in the way they're going to live their lives. So and it just encapsulated everything that was happening in that century.
And this obviously was an era where women did not have a lot of sort of overt power, and yet clearly Elizabeth and her daughters proved to be among the most influential people of the century. How did they go about that?
They, you know, women were not allowed to be openly, like a princess could not sell her work as for art, for example, but they could mm-hmm. paint, but they couldn't be sell it as you could today. Later, you couldn't be an acknowledged artist. But people worked in the sidelines. You couldn't be a scholar either. But her eldest daughter was a great scholar, and she was part of this community of intellectuals. And she actually became very close with Descartes, who was the principal philosopher in Europe at the time, and helped his career, helped his thought. It was more than just being amused. They went back and forth and talked about books and talked about math and philosophy. And so they had that. But the one who did it the most was the youngest daughter, Sophia, because she was the only one to actually get married and have children. And she also married a German count, the Duke of Hanover, and she was one of the most educated women in Europe. The great philosopher Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz was her secretary, although they were really more like collaborators. actually, she worked on projects with him. It was very unusual for the 17th century. In fact, when she wrote to her niece one time, and she said, she was extolling Leibniz's qualities, and the niece wrote back and said, in effect, how wonderful it was to have found so amiable and accomplished a scholar who didn't smell. That's kind of how
One of the things that struck me too about the era is that for the big scale on which these things are playing out, it so much of it also seemed like sort of squabbles among these relatively small families. I mean, it so much was depending on who married whom in those days, and it seems like wars were beginning and empires were rising and falling based on little children being set up with each other.
That's yes, and it's all about inherit. Who's going to inherit this, and who's going to get the property here? But the youngest one, Sophia, the way she got the British crown was she actually went out and negotiated for it. She skipped over about 50 other people. She was not in line. No woman. She was the youngest daughter in a family that had. Men, her brothers had married and had children. There's just no way that she should have gotten anywhere near the monarchy. But she knew how to negotiate, and she met with William III, who was the King of England at the time, William I, William and Mary, and she offered him support in his fight against France, Louis XIV, the Sun King, and she said, "I'll give you this if you give me the crown," and he did. And that is, everyone comes from her. Everyone and all the way down the line. That Meghan Markle is marrying into Sophia's family.
You're listening to True Story. This show is a copyrighted podcast solely owned by the authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I'm Brian Freeman, and my latest thriller is Alter Ego, which is available in hardcover, ebook, and audio right now. I'm talking with Nancy Goldstone, author of the wry and engrossing new history, Daughters of the Winter Queen, which is available now from Little Brown. You know, we've been talking a little bit about the youngest daughter, Sophia, and one of the things I thought was interesting was that she wrote her memoirs, and you quote her memoirs extensively from out the book. I was wondering, I mean, how common was it for people to write memoirs of that nature in the 17th century, and in particular, how common was it for women to write their memoirs?
You know, they didn't do it very often, but if you were an educated woman like Sophia, and even earlier, if you were a princess, they did write their memoirs. They did sit down and try to explain their side of the story often to, because in my earlier book, I did a book called Rival Queens, and there, Marguerite de Valois, she was Queen Margot in France in the 16th century. She also wrote her memoirs, but the really fabulous thing about Sophia's memoirs is she sounds just like Jane Austen. She's got that wonderful, wit. She had a really, her engagement was something out of Pride and Prejudice, because she was supposed to marry, she was asked to marry the oldest brother, the Duke of Hanover, and then he went away to Venice like he usually does, and he was a bachelor for a long time, and he really decided he didn't want to be married anymore, but he'd already made this commitment to her. So what he did was is he bribed his younger brother to take over his engagement for him, and he offered the younger brother all his lands to do this, and the younger brother said, because the younger brother was never going to inherit anything, this way he would get property, he said, sure, I'll do it. And they go to Sophia and say they're making this switch, and she goes along with it because she wants a home, because she's got to get out of her brother's home because his marriage is disintegrating on an epic scale, and she needed to get out of there. So she marries the younger brother, and she says, I was so happy to find out that he was lovable because I was determined to love him. And it's just got that same Jane Austen kind of wit about her.
I loved her little sly asides, just like I liked your sly asides throughout the book. And I will say the whole marriage with Sophia, that was where I was starting to think that this was sort of beginning to resemble a bit of a TV soap opera here. And there were any number of sort of dynasty worthy anecdotes throughout the book. But since you brought up the original Duke that was supposed to marry Sophia, you've got to tell us about his ultimate marriage to his anti-wife.
Yes, I know. They were so creative when it came to getting what they wanted. Because the older brother eventually does fall in love, and he falls in love with somebody who's inappropriate, a lady-in-waiting, a French woman, and she is trying to hold out for marriage. But he can't marry her because he's already promised Sophia and his younger brother that he wouldn't marry anyone, because his property's got to go to the younger brother because he bribed her to take Sophia. So he's got to find a way to make this woman happy, and so that he can have sex with her, but she can't marry her. So they come up with this great contract, and I don't know why we don't have these today, honestly. It's called the anti-marriage. He got up in front of all of his family and signed a contract and said he couldn't marry her, but he would never marry anyone else. And he set a little property on her, and she went with it. And that's an anti-marriage.
And so is that what they actually called it back then?
Yes, it was an anti-marriage. Yes, that was what. And eventually the woman is smarter than the guy, and she gets the emperor to make her legitimately married, which really, you know, to legitimize her marriage, because she's with him a long time, and that's when Sophia gets really upset, because that threatens the inheritance of her children. She ends up having
right.
to marry her son to the woman's daughter just to keep all the property in the family.
Well, you know,
really,
it is such an amazing story that, I mean, here you have Sophia. She's the 12th child, youngest daughter of Elizabeth the Winter Queen. She's her German husband of no particular importance in the grand scheme of things, and yet if she'd lived just a little bit longer, she would have been Queen of Great Britain herself. And as it is, her son George became George the First, and now here we are all these centuries later, and we're still celebrating a British monarchy that dates back to Sophia. Talk a little bit more about, I mean, this is such an astonishing story of political maneuvering. Talk a little bit more about, how did she make this happen?
I don't think they really understand it in Britain anymore, because they know George the First inherited, they know Sophia was supposed to inherit and then her son came, but they seem to think that it was a passive kind of inheritance, that she was next in line. No way. What was happening at the time was that Louis XIV did Versailles, right? That's what he's the Sun King. That's all we think. I don't know if anyone's seen they did a series called Versailles. It's not actually accurate, but it's a lot of fun. But it's about Louis XIV. But what Louis XIV was in the 17th century was, he was a menace. He had armies, and he's like Putin. He's like going out and trying to take over other people's property. He's expanding to French borders to the north, to the east, to the west. He's really trying to make France a huge power by occupying other people's territory. And he comes into contact, you know, he comes into conflict then with England, which is historically at odds with France anyway, and sees this as a huge threat, and especially Holland. Louis XIV really wanted to take over Holland, and he almost did. The only way they got out of it was they opened the dikes and basically drowned the whole country so he couldn't get in there and take it over. So William is King of England, but he was also from Holland. He was the William of Orange. He was the stadtholder. He was the main guy in Holland, and he really wanted to protect Holland, and Sophia knew this. So she brought her daughter. Her daughter was married to, at that time, she was an adult by that time, and she had married a guy named the Elector of Brandenburg. It was around Berlin. It was a little county kind of thing. And she brought her daughter with her, and she sat down in a secret meeting with William of England, and she said, okay, what we're going to do is you put me in the succession. I'm the next in line after Queen Anne and all of my descendants, and I will support you. I will give you money. I will give, because her husband had died by that time, but her son was there, and she could speak for him. And she said, we will support you militarily. We will give you money. We will fight Louis XIV with you. But also, I want my daughter to be a queen. So what I want you to do is, I want you to talk to the emperor, who is your ally also. He also was fighting Louis XIV. And I want you to make her little Brandenburg, I want that to be a kingdom too. Now, she did that to make her daughter a queen, because she wanted her daughter raised to royalty, but also because Brandenburg was in line for the succession, only they weren't as smart about it as Sophia, but they could easily have gotten the succession of Great Britain instead of her. But she arranged it that they would have their own kingdom, and that becomes the Kingdom of Prussia, so the Kingdom of Prussia is going to be, that's where we get later Frederick the Great, that's Germany, that's the Kaiser Wilhelm, all this stuff that comes out, the Kingdom of Prussia. The Kingdom of Prussia was created as the consolation prize for not getting the throne of England, basically. And that's how that came into being.
Well, this is obviously
very smart.
This is obviously a big week for the British monarchy. I'm sure a lot of listeners have their DVRs set to record the royal wedding this week. I'm curious, how do you compare and contrast the pomp and circumstance of the modern royal era with the trappings of royalty in the 17th century?
They're basically it's the same stuff. It's there when they go in for the ceremony, when they have a coronation you'll see the, exactly what happened with Victoria, what happened with Elizabeth II. Those are the coronations based on the past. And this, I think, what you have here is Meghan Markle had to, she didn't have to, but I think she was gracious enough to convert to the Anglican religion, because what people, I think, forget here in the United States is that the Queen is head of the church, because that happened in the way back in the 16th century with Henry VIII. And Henry VIII was kind of the Harvey Weinstein of the 16th century. He wanted to sleep with Anne Boleyn, but he was married to Catherine of Aragon, and it took a long time to get the Pope wasn't agreeing to give him an annulment, and so he said, "Okay, I'm going to be head of the church, and I'm going to take over the monarchy." He didn't do it out of any religious feeling or reform. He just wanted to be able to get divorced from Catherine of Aragon, and so that's how the British monarchy became head of the Anglican Church, and that they fought for that for a long, long time. That was a cause of great strife. So they've got so much history behind it, so much blood behind it, that they have to hold on to it. This 16th century, institution, at into the 21st century, and it creates these kind of problems.
The book is Daughters of the Winter Queen by Nancy Goldstone. If you are a fan of history books, this is one you simply do not want to miss. It's a wonderful story, and it is wonderfully written. Nancy, if people want to learn more about you and about your book, where can they go?
They can go to my website, nancygoldstone.com, or they can go to Amazon page and see Daughters of the Winter Queen. Those would probably be the best places.
Excellent. Well, Nancy, this has been so much fun. I thoroughly enjoyed your book. I hope all of our listeners go out and get a copy for themselves. Thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Thank you.
This is Brian Freeman, and you've been listening to True Story on the Authors on the Air Network. Be sure to visit authorsontheair.com for more interviews with best-selling writers in every genre. That's authorsontheair.com. I know you never want to miss an episode of True Story, so go to Facebook and like my show page at facebook.com/truestoryradio. That's facebook.com/truestoryradio, and you'll find links to all of my past shows and announcements of what's coming up next. And if you want to find out more about my books, and I know you do, then go out to my website at bfreemanbooks.com. That's one word, bfreemanbooks.com. And be sure to check out my latest books this year, Alter Ego and The Voice Inside. Thanks for listening, everybody, and happy reading.